Hello and welcome to another episode of the Dermatilla Diaries. Today I have with me a very special guest, Natasha Negovanlis. Natasha is a Canadian Screen Award-winning actress, as well as a writer and producer based out in Toronto, Canada, who gained popularity for playing broody lesbian vampire Carmilla in the series and movie of the same name. Since then, she has a number of roles in films and television shows and earned a global fan base on social media, where she is admired for her candid posts about mental health awareness, intersectional feminism, and positive STLGBTQ plus representation. Thank you so much for joining me today, Natasha.
Oh my gosh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's so amazing to be able to sit and chat with you. Such an extraordinary person in your achievements and, you know, an advocate for this very niche but growing community. It would be so interesting to hear more about your story and, you know, you speaking up and sharing it with many different people. So I kind of wanted to start with like where your skin picking journeys began.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, I suppose I've been doing it since I was a kid, but like so many people with this disorder, I didn't realize it was an actual disorder for a very long time. So I think it probably began kindergarten, grade one, with nail biting, skin picking around my cuticles. That's where it all began. And, you know, as puberty hit and we start getting hairier and the acne starts forming, which I luckily did not suffer from, but, you know, I get the odd zit. There was this fascination with trying to perfect those things. Mm-hmm. And of course, as we know, we don't actually perfect anything, but that's a lot of the motivation for me. I feel like what's unique about skin picking is the sort of goal-oriented aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But it really didn't manifest into something that became very serious and very troubling probably until about 2015. Okay. And at that point, I had finally quit my waitressing job. My career was going really well. I started getting all of the things I had always hoped and dreamed for. And yet there was this little thing. And it took me a while to realize the parallels between that and to be curious about it in therapy with my therapist going like, huh, isn't that interesting that this like this really became a problem as soon as nice things started happening for me that I'd worked so hard for. So it started with, I would say, one ingrown hair on my leg. And it just spiraled. And I remember the very first a red carpet I did in the US. And I had picked so much in my hotel room the night before. And I sprayed my legs down with aerosol makeup on my own. I said this on my own podcast, Vanless Presents, when I was interviewing Lauren, the co-founder of Picking Me Foundation. But I said it looked like I murdered an Oompa Loompa in my hotel room because there was just makeup spray everywhere. It was kind of orange. So I had done that. And throughout my career, when there were times I knew I was going to be on camera, I was pretty good about really curbing those rituals. But as soon as I would wrap, it would begin again. And as I've gotten older, I'm 31, I don't heal as fast. So scarring is happening, which really wasn't a problem before. And I think it wasn't until really the pandemic that I sought out real specific help for this specifically. You know, I'd been doing therapy for a few years for other things, but during the pandemic, it just completely spiraled. Like without having to be on camera, living alone, the stress and grief that I was going through, I could not control this compulsion at all. And I started doing more research and discovered that this is something that I don't suffer alone from, you know?
Mm. And I'm sure that when you first did that research, I don't know about you, but I didn't expect there to be very many people online saying that they were struggling with the same thing, because it's a very isolating disorder. You know, you spend a lot of time on your own, that guilt and shame, it's hard to share with other people. So it's, you feel very isolated and alienated within it. And so I imagine when you did your research and looked into it, it must have been quite relieving to realize that you weren't alone.
Yeah. I have to give credit to one of my good friends who goes by Mo Thunder on Instagram. They're an Indigenous artist. And this was probably about 2018. And shortly after we had met, I saw this beautiful piece of art that they posted on their Instagram. And it was a portrait of their own legs and this beautiful poem where they referred to it as a constellation of stars or scars. And their legs, the image of their legs, I went, oh my God, that looks like mine. And I remember texting them going, I do this too. And they used the hashtag excoriation disorder. So that was really the catalyst to my journey eventually finding a proper diagnosis, was clicking on that hashtag and seeing so many accounts about it. And then I think it wasn't until 2020 and having lots of time on my hands to scroll through social media, which has not always been productive. But once I did that and I found Picking Me Foundation and I found your wonderful posts, I started following you and Picking Me. And I was like, oh, this is a real thing.
Yeah. And I think it's great that with social media, I mean, it gets a terrible rep, doesn't it? With all of the negative aspects of mental health and how people can be perceived online, the different ways they want to show themselves, express themselves. But I also think that with social media, it's such an amazing tool to spread positive awareness, or just awareness on things, even if you're struggling. You know, it's by being vulnerable and sharing your truth out there with other people, I guess, a bit of relief from sharing it, but also you're helping so many people too. And I feel like that's massively contributed to the overall awareness of this disorder, because people, you know, can relate, and it pushes other people to perhaps share their story. And it's just like a snowball effect.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for that piece of art that my friend created. And, you know, after that last year and moreover this year, when I really started talking about it quite a bit on my Instagram and the little quarantine podcast I made, what really struck me was a lot of like friends of friends or people I followed on Instagram that I maybe met at a party, like people who are more my peers versus, you know, just fans and followers, they started sending me private messages going, oh my God, I do this too. So it was really neat to meet people that I had met in real life and I had no idea under their clothing were suffering from the same thing I was. What also really strikes me as interesting is that everyone I know is either an AFAB person, assigned female at birth, non-binary person, or a woman, a cis woman. Everyone I know who suffers with this is. Now, I'm sure there are exceptions, but I do find it really interesting that a lot of people who suffer from this, at least everyone I know now in my own community, are women or AFAB people who are quite high achieving and quite brilliant and quite talented in whatever respective field they work in. And I was like, that is also a very interesting coincidence. What is that?
Yeah, I remember looking at some research that was suggesting that there's a higher percent of those, whether they, you know, identify as women or they were born female. So identify as female or born female. Because with these type of people, we have a higher chance of internalizing how we feel. And I think I think that internalization of feeling that you can't channel your emotions and how you're really feeling about something and having to take that back inwards, it must have something to do with our bodily focused repetitive behaviors, because we're using these physical behaviors as a way to self-soothe instead of communicating in a verbal sense. It's kind of like a physical communication instead of a verbal communication, if that makes sense.
It does. And it's interesting because as women, I think we have the advantage of having grown up in a society that does encourage us to share our feelings more so than men and cis men. But that being said, I feel like anyone who's neurodiverse or on a spectrum, whether it be ADHD or OCD or autism or all of the above, what is really interesting is a lot of the research has always, or almost all of the research has only ever been done on small cisgender boys. And also they act out differently. So perhaps they're hyper or they're violent or they're disrupting the classroom, whereas women really internalize it and take it in as failure. And so although we've been more encouraged to share our feelings, at the same time, when we are struggling, it's seen as an inability to multitask, or it's seen as a failure. And I think that has a lot to do with it. I'm so glad that we're becoming more aware of terms like neurodiversity. I would say I'm someone who identifies as neurodiverse. I was diagnosed to be on the OCD spectrum, which we now understand that BFRBs are under that umbrella of obsessive compulsive disorder. But I also am quite convinced that I'm also on the ADHD spectrum. But, you know, as a kid, it was like, oh, I was labeled as a gifted kid. And then when I was struggling with certain things or having anxiety, they were like, oh, she's just putting too much pressure on herself to do well in school or continue these straight A's or things like that. And so, yeah, I think a lot of it, as you said, was like the self-soothing, I kind of understand, because I do find one of my triggers, you know, can be after a really long run of a show or after a lot of travel or being alone in my hotel room, or the opposite, where I'm just really bored and I'm not working at all and I can't focus. It's something to focus on.
I completely, well, not in the same sense, because I definitely don't have the type of career that you do, but I definitely agree that if I have a really busy day, even if it's a really fun day, I had a great time, I'm coming back, I'm pumped, I'm excited, I'll still go and self-soothe. I don't have to be in a low mood to do it.
No, me too.
Like a self-regulation. It's like bringing me down to this kind of comfortable level of soothing, I guess. And then on the other hand, I can have, as you say, a really slow, boring day, not doing anything. And I'll just pick, you know, there's so many times I'll be watching TV, and it'll be a trigger in itself to be like, well, you know, let's just have a little feel. Let's just see how the skin's looking, knowing full well what that will then go into.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's two types of it. There's the sort of like automatic picking where maybe I don't even realize I'm doing it, and I'll sort of, you know, feel an imperfection of my thumb or something. Like I pick my thumbs quite a bit. Or there is the very aware focus pulling, where it's like, I'll get a visual trigger. And then it's the addictiveness of it. It's, oh, well, I got some sense of satisfaction removing this ingrown hair. And there's something to do, at least for me, with almost like removing impurities, if that makes sense. Even though logically it's like, just leave it, just leave it. It'll clear up on its own. It's fine.
Yeah. And every time we do it, it always makes it worse. Like I have 16 years of doing it. There's not been one occasion that I can remember anyway, where my picking helped the situation in that area, but it's literally the same for me. For me, I know some people love watching those like pimple popping shows and stuff, and that's, you know, that's totally fair. I can't watch those things. Like it, I don't know what it does. I just can't watch it. But to me, when I'm skin picking, it's literally, I need to remove what's there. What is there is not meant to be there in my mind. It's got to go. And I'm doing a good thing by getting rid of it. But it's also like, if you can't control, to me anyway, if I can't control external things, I think another sense of my skin picking has been this element of I can control how my skin is.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm the same. I can't watch those videos. I don't find them interesting or soothing at all, but I also kind of find them triggering, because they'll just sort of inspire me to do the same. And it's interesting because just from, you know, a societal standard of beauty, I find it really interesting that a lot of people who struggle with this are also sort of, you know, based on whatever patriarchal European views of beauty, but like a lot of people who do this are stereotypically very attractive. Like, you're a very beautiful person and you're very striking. And so it is very interesting because that almost feeds into the feeling of guilt. You know, I think like for a lot of my life, people always commented on how beautiful my skin was. Mm. There was so much focus on my skin. And even though it was a positive thing and it was a compliment, it almost made me turn my attention to my skin in ways that I hadn't as well. You know, people would always say, oh my God, your skin's amazing. And I'm very lucky that I didn't have acne on my face growing up because I would look completely different now. I'd probably be completely scarred. But as I got older, I got very prone to ingrown hairs, ingrown body hairs. And that's where the picking started.
Mm. Yeah, I can relate to an extent. I know that I used to get acne face and body, not so much my face now, but I do still get it on my body. And that's where my picking is. And I think some people can see my content and they might message me and they'll say, you know, your skin looks fine. Like, you know, but they're only seeing an area that I'm not picking a lot. And the reason I don't pick my face a lot anymore is because I was on medication a few years ago that's really thinned my skin on my face. So now it's not satisfying because if I pick, I will create quite a deep wound. So it's definitely changed my patterns because it's that or like really deep scarring on the face. But because of that, some people might seem like, oh, but your skin looks fine. And then, you know, you then are faced with two things. It's like you feel like you're not believed, like it's not believable what you're saying. But also it's kind of highlighting that people are evaluating your skin closer, which is quite, to me, triggering and quite makes me feel uncomfortable in itself when I feel like there's eyes on my skin.
Yeah, I feel the same way. So even prior to my scarring on my leg and my legs, and bikini line area, even prior to that, I didn't feel comfortable wearing a bathing suit in public ever. Mm. Like ever. Like I'd wear one pieces or just wouldn't do it. Few and far between, I can count on my fingers the amount of times I've worn a bathing suit in public over the past decade. And as I mentioned, even prior to the scarring, I think a lot of it was just eyes on me. Mm. Just the attention. Because before it was like, you know, I'd tan and it was like, oh, your skin. It's so nice. And I know it sounds, for someone who doesn't suffer from this, it's like, what's wrong with you? Like you're being attention seeking or like, why would you not want these compliments or things like that? But to me, it made me really uncomfortable. I didn't like feeling sexualized. I just didn't like it. And, so I would really, really hide. And now I hide completely. I mean, this whole past summer, not a single beach day. That's like my biggest nightmare. No swimming, you know, because I couldn't even wear shorts because I look at my legs and they're horrible. And I don't feel comfortable sharing those images with the public yet. So although I have come out, for lack of a better word, with this disorder and I posted about it, I haven't actually shown pictures of my skin because I think it would just make me quite upset. Like I don't want to have images of my skin ever. And then it's interesting because I went to, prior to the pandemic, of course, I went to Cuba with my mom and there were a couple of photos that she took of me and, you know, I'm in shorts, my bathing suit, cause it was just her and I, and there wasn't really anyone around. And I didn't want to post them or share them. And I was so ashamed of them because I had a little bit of scarring on my legs and some fresh wounds from skin picking. Mm-hmm. But now I look at those and I go, oh my God, that's like an eighth of what I've done now. So it's all sort of relative.
Yeah. It's not easy when you're looking back on photos. And it's interesting how we all, when we look at pictures of ourselves, we focus on areas that could be completely different to how someone else who's looking at that photo would look at it. I remember talking to someone one time and she was saying about how, I think it was like, she didn't like her ankles, And so every time we, like, if we were like complimenting someone or like, oh, she looks really nice, that's a lovely outfit, she would like say, you know, her ankles are so nice, like she's got beautiful ankle. And it's just not something that I would like look at someone and go straight to the ankles. But obviously that's an area of the body that my friend was feeling very self-conscious about. And so it's an area that she's focusing on. And, you know, whether it's us looking at pictures of ourselves in the past, or it's looking at other people walking down the street, it's so interesting. Those of us that have disorders like this, where, you know, there's physical evidence, we can look down at our skin and see what we've done. It's so easy for us to just like fixate on certain areas and just not, I don't know, like, as you say, that was an older picture. You say it was an eighth of something that would be the case now, but at the time that was like, you know, a huge deal. And now
Yeah, I look at them and I think, oh, that's the goal now. If I can only get to this place where I could like heal like that again, if only I looked like that again. And now it's like, yeah, it's like, oh, that looks great. But at the time it was just so, there was so much shame and guilt.
There's so much shame and guilt with dermatillomania, isn't it? It's like a cycle. Do you feel like that the shame and guilt kind of propels you to pick more? It's like a, you know, it adds fuel to the fire to do it more.
Yeah, it is definitely a cycle, because then you have these overwhelming feelings and you want to regulate those feelings, and then you pick again, but then you feel bad because you picked. And it's been interesting, because now that things have opened up a little bit more in Toronto where I am, I've had less time to pick, but then I do find also being busy again, I'll have like an extra long session when I do have downtime. So I'm sort of like, well, what is worse? Because I was picking every day and I go, okay, great. I'm not picking every day now. Maybe it's down to like one or two times a week versus every day, like it was during the pandemic. But those one or two times are really long sessions.
Yeah.
And I've been doing a lot of voice acting. So there is a part of me that almost rationalizes it, going, well, like, oh, it doesn't matter what you look like now anymore. Because no one's going to see you. But then it's like, well, you have to see you.
It's funny how easy we can manipulate it to work for our change of environments. So it's like, okay, I'm doing this now. This means I can't do this. Okay. Well, where's my opportunity today? When can I be alone and kind of make up for the time lost?
Yes. Yeah.
So with you sharing your story online and sharing your truth with others, how was that experience?
It was really scary to share it. And I'm sure you experienced this as well, particularly because your Instagram is so focused on this. And you know, when you're doing more quote unquote influencing, for lack of a better word, you know, there can be this fear of judgment. There can be this fear of, I think anytime you share anything that's like, oh, this is something quote unquote wrong with me, you think, you know, there'll be people who will say, oh, you're just attention seeking, or have a negative reaction to it. But I'm very lucky, to be honest. I would say like 99% has been really positive feedback, because it's a lot of people thanking me for making them not feel alone and not weird. And that is very rewarding and very special. And it's been really neat to use this audience I grew from acting work that I did years ago, and to be able to use this audience as a platform to help others and to talk about this. The first step is just talking about it.
It really is. That's half the battle, isn't it? It's like just accepting and allowing out in the open and be like, I do this, and then take the first step. And then after that, kind of gets
it's healing for me too, because I don't know if you find this, but like I did find, once I did post about it in great detail and did share that podcast episode where I went into pretty graphic detail about what I had been suffering with alone or suffering from alone, I did find that I picked a little bit less. Like it almost gave me permission to stop, because it just, and I haven't stopped completely, but there was just this thing of like, oh, people know now, so there can be more support.
Mm. Yeah. There's not as much, maybe there wasn't as much shame put on yourself mm-hmm. after that, because there was a sense of acceptance.
Absolutely.
And when we're telling ourselves, like, don't pick, you can't do this, you know, you need to stop this, we have to figure it out, find a cure, like, this can't continue. That's when we tend to pick more, right? Because we're just going to do the opposite of what we're saying, especially if it's our comfort blanket emotionally. If it's something that we've been going to self-soothe and make us feel comfortable in you know, potentially unnerving or overwhelming, anxious situations, whatever it is that can trigger us, we're always going to go back to that thing that makes us feel comfortable. And if it's been skin picking for a long time, it's unrealistic for us to think that it's going to be an overnight change, like something's just going to come along and we're just going to stop. And I don't know about you, but I, you know, for years was just telling myself, I'll grow out of this. And when I get this, I'm going to stop it. When I have achieved this, or I move in with someone, or all these little milestones in my life, like when I do that, or when I get to that, it's going to stop. And, you know, it doesn't, obviously.
No, it doesn't. And I'm very curious to know from a scientific perspective, if there is something in the brain that resembles an addict almost, because there is this element of like a sense of higher achievement, you know, when you get like the perfect pick, and it sounds so gross, but there is that. And on one hand, I'm like, I hate that I do this, but I'm also glad that I somehow was attracted to this and chose this versus something that was even more harmful to myself. Like I do, there is this element of self-harm, but it's not self-harm. And that is also the struggle is getting people to understand that it's not the same as cutting. But I do find sometimes there is this element of punishment almost for myself, or a way of bringing myself down. It's like, I would rationalize like, oh, well, I can't, you know, get new headshots or audition for this, or, you know, I have to not audition for any roles that require me to show my legs right now because they're ugly. They're ugly. And I'm going to have to wait until I heal. But then it's a way of like holding myself back from success that I say I want, but there's this fear of success, or there's this feeling of like, oh, I just booked this role, or, oh, I'm going to do a photo shoot. Or, you know, I'm, you know, when I feel like when I met my partner, we really fell in love. It's like, oh, I'm going to be intimate with someone. And then I would pick, and then I would ruin that opportunity. And then I'd be like, oh, wait, no, I can't, because now I picked. So it was like a way of holding myself back from pleasant things in life.
Yeah, it definitely can hold us back. I think one thing as well, when we're so used to seeing the marks on our skin day in, day out for years on end, that becomes very comfortable. It may not be someone else's normal, but it becomes our normal. It's what we are used to seeing in the mirror when we look down at our skin. And it's, you know, even though so many of us want clear skin, you know, no more marks, and to just look in quote normal, that in itself becomes uncomfortable. It's easy for us to forget how that is and how to maintain that. And so I think there's a lot of self-sabotage that
there is. For me, it's still not my norm. Like, even though I've been doing this badly for quite a few years, let's say at this level about 3 years, I'm still not used to seeing it. Like, sometimes I still have an image in my mind of me in the before times. And it's weird because even with things like body dysmorphia, it's like, you know, my legs were my best, whatever feature by, again, societal standards. So it'd be like, oh, well, my legs are really thin, and so I'm going to wear a short skirt and show off my legs, but like hide my belly or something. And now it's sort of like the opposite, where it's like, oh, I took my best feature and I just like made it my worst feature. Again, I'm using these words as like they're ridiculous words to use, because it's really like, I have some marks on my legs. Who cares? This shouldn't actually make it terrible. And, you know, it's interesting to me because my partner doesn't really see them. Like, sometimes he'll clock them just to be like, are you okay, honey? Or like, I'll show him. Or, you know, he'll check in with me on an emotional and mental level if he notices that it's maybe slightly worse than it is. But most of the time, he's not really looking at them or noticing them.
No, that's good.
And he will often say to me, like, I wish you saw yourself the way I see you, because I don't see that. I don't look at those things. And I do think about it, like, you know, I've certainly been intimate with or dated a lot of people who maybe don't fit a societal standard of like beauty or whatever, but like I look at them and I never saw anything like that. Or, you know, I remember I identify as bi or pansexual, and I remember dating like women who had a lot of stretch marks and they were like so ashamed of it. And I was like, oh my gosh, I love these. They're like your cool thunderbolts on your thighs. And like, I thought they were really sexy and like, you know, but it's just so interesting. And it's like, so every once in a while, I have to remind myself of that, going like, oh yeah, like if I was dating someone with a skin picking disorder, I'd be concerned for them and I'd want to support their mental health, but I also wouldn't be looking at them being like, oh, that's gross. You know?
Yeah, true. It sounds like you've got a very supportive other half, and you're very clearly a very supportive person, very loving and able to see past these things. I know not everybody sadly has those around them that share the same views, and it's sad. There's still a lot of social stigma around dermatillomania. A lot of people still think, you know, it's a habit and nothing more. But hopefully in time, with the awareness as well, we can hopefully see a change in that. Talking about like your you know, in quote, better features, you know, and what you'd like to show off and dress to accentuate. Like, how has being an on-screen actor in front of a camera and for that to be a norm, how has that kind of been with your dermatillomania?
When I knew I had a movie coming up, I was much better at curbing the habit when it came to my legs. If I knew there was a close up, sometimes it would change my wardrobe. Like when I played Carmilla, I there were a lot of outfits where I was wearing like high stockings, if ever I wasn't wearing pants, but I was also very lucky that she was in pants quite a bit. In terms of like events and things like that, you know, sometimes I'd have to do like a last minute outfit change and wear pants because I was ashamed of it. One thing I laughed about is that, and I don't know if you find this, but I found acrylic nails would really help me sometimes. Mm-hmm. More so because I did start using tools on other parts of my body. But more so for my cuticles, I found it very helpful to wear acrylic nails because I couldn't go like this and I couldn't like, you know, peel at things because they weren't sharp. But the irony about that is that people would then, like random strangers, you know, on the internet with nothing better to do, would then question my sexuality because there is like a joke that like, or, you know, some reality that like queer women have to have short nails. And like, if you have long nails, then you're not having sex with women. And like the irony was, while I was struggling with this, particularly on my hands, and I knew I was filming things and there was going to be close-ups on my hands, I was dating women. Like I had a girlfriend at the time and I was like, no, the whole point is they're not sharp. So like, I'm not hurting my girlfriend. Also, there's many different ways to have sex. And also I'm literally getting these acrylic nails done because as soon as I would do it, it would give me like 2 weeks of healing time for my cuticles. So I'd be like, okay, I'm going to get these done and then I'm going to play this role. And then I know that if I have a close-up of like me holding something, I know that it's going to look okay. So that is quite funny. That is sort of the irony of it all. Cause I don't even like, I use my hands quite a bit. I love to work with clay. I love to paint and things like that. I play softball. So having acrylic nails was not particularly convenient for me. I didn't like having long nails. I love them on other people, but for me, it wasn't like my aesthetic style, but I got them literally so I would stop hurting myself. Like I was like, yeah, I'd love to have short nails, but can't do that right now.
Gosh, yeah, they are very helpful. I know a lot of people in our community really benefit from them, and I guess it depends on the trigger areas, like where you like to pick more. I find that they're helpful, but yeah, as you say, I do. I like CrossFit, and you know, a lot of that is like you know, going on the bar, swinging on the bars and catching this and throwing this about. And when you've got long nails, it's been a couple of times where I've chipped them or a bit of nails went back and I'm like, oh my God, the pain. But they're not always practical. But I guess, like, you know, if it's all test and learn and finding out what works for each person and going with
and
it.
As you said, there's you know, it depends on what part of your body you are focusing on at the moment. So if I really was focusing on my cuticles, the acrylic nails were very helpful because, as I said, I couldn't pick my cuticles. However, if I started getting really focused on my legs, it actually, or like zits or something, it would actually make picking those things or squishing those things easier. So it was sort of this, like, it's this thing. So I really rotate between, you know, sometimes like right now, oh my God, my nail polish just chipped, but right now I've cut my nails really, really short. So because right now my legs are a big trigger. And any sort of like little zits I get on my arms or something. So I needed to cut them extremely short so that I couldn't pick anything.
Mm. And I mean, at least like you're very self-aware, you're aware of the areas and you're aware of like what you need to do to help your management of skin picking. Have you got any other things that you like, ways that you've implemented in your routine that's helped you manage your skin picking as well as the shorter nails?
Yes, I'm not always very good at this, but one thing I started doing once in a while, again, sometimes you get sucked into a black hole of picking, but there were a few times when I started picking and then I was able to kind of come out of the quote unquote trance. And I set a timer for 15 minutes and then I just allowed myself to have a picking session. But then as soon as that alarm went off, I went, okay, you need to stop now. So being gentle with myself has been very helpful because it's like, as you said, this is not something that's just going to be cured overnight. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of work. There's a psychological aspect. There's like a more scientific aspect to it, you know? And so being gentle with myself and going like, okay, this is a self-soothing thing that I'm doing, which ultimately, like, I look at my scars now and I go, well, these scars suck, but these scars also prevented me from hurting myself in worse ways, especially as someone who has had suicidal ideation and things like that. It's like this allowed me to soothe in ways that allowed me to not take things further and not dive into cutting or things like that. So I do feel as if the learning to be accepting of my own disorder has been helpful because, you know, 15 minutes of picking will do a lot less damage than 2 hours of picking. And I also find lighting is a really big thing, and it sounds very strange and odd, but like I go to the bathroom in like the semi-dark quite a bit. I treated myself to some nightlights that are like cute little salt lamps. So using sort of self-care techniques has been helpful. Like, oh, I'm going to indulge and treat myself to a number of really beautiful candles so that if I have my apartment candlelit, the lighting is softer and I won't get visual triggers and things like that. And it's better for my hydro bill as well, my electric bill, because it's like I'm kind of like lurking in the dark all the time now, which has been really helpful. And I, as you can see, I now like unfortunately live in this little hobbit hole of a basement apartment, which, you know, sometimes sucks, but also has kind of been good because not having as much intense lighting down here has really helped with that. And knowing the bathroom is like the bathroom mirror is a trigger area. One thing that also really helped me was being really honest about it with my partner in ways that I hadn't been with previous partners. Like sometimes I'd be like, oh yeah, I have this thing. But I really talked about it in great depth, to the point where I remember last year in the pandemic actually showing him the tools that I use. And I've never gone quite that far when describing it to someone. And it was a very vulnerable time. And I'm very, very, very lucky that I have this type of relationship because I know not everyone does. And this is certainly the first time I've had this type of relationship. And, you know, and it took like 30 years, but it was a very vulnerable moment and I cried, but, you know, having him being like, I had no idea, but he was very gentle about it. And he was like, I had no idea that like, this is what you use. And so it sounds strange, but I actually like had him help me collect everything and like throw it out. Or if I did feel like I needed tweezers to pluck my eyebrows now and again, I actually had him like hide them somewhere in my apartment. And it sounds strange, especially for someone who I am quite a control freak and very dominant personality. And there are aspects of my personality that are stereotypically masculine, whatever, because we assign gender to assertiveness, but whatever. So having someone like be in control was kind of strange. Not that he was, but it was sort of just like a, you know, I'd have to ask him and be like, can I have my tweezers so I can pluck my eyebrows? But having someone like be there for me and monitor that so that they're not just accessible all the time was really helpful.
Yeah. That it's great that, that he's been so on board with supporting you, you know, in your management in terms of like taking the tools and putting them in a safe space and knowing that like that you can come to him for support, whether it's talking, whether it's sharing your tools, which must have been an incredibly vulnerable experience because these are physical objects. And when we're using them for such an intimate disorder that we, you know, it really can feel like it controls us and unable to share with others our true self. So these objects are very emotionally charged, and to have that conversation and be like, here, you know, I use these, that must have taken a lot of courage to do.
I definitely felt like a freak, you know, I felt weird. It was strange and scary. And I mean, thank you for saying that. I have realized that there is so much courage in being vulnerable. And I was someone who was like vehemently like anti-long-term relationship, anti-partnership. I clocked when you said my other half because and I know it's just a phrase we use in society, but I don't actually see it like that. Like I say, like, we are totally like whole individuals who are choosing to share our lives together. I always saw like partnerships even as like a form of weakness, which I know also sounds bananas, but I was like, oh, well, like I like relationships and I'm loyal and monogamous, but like, I never want to get married. I never want to have like a long-term partner. I don't want these things. I don't believe in forever. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, it actually takes a lot of courage to share all of yourself with someone. Mm-hmm. Even these mental health disorders. And actually it's kind of cool, and that it doesn't actually be a weakness. It's not like I need the support from him, but I'm lucky I have it and I want it. And that's also very cool. And like it, there was such a sense of self-worth and growth in myself and confidence that I had the courage to ask for help, because I never asked for help from anyone. I mean, you know, my mother is a wonderful mother, and like, you know, bless her for acknowledging that both her children had very different personalities. And I was extremely independent from day one. And, you know, it probably broke her heart letting me have that independence. You know, she probably wanted to help me more with things, but I just never, never wanted help from anyone. And I saw it as like a negative thing, and it's really not. So I feel like a lot of people who suffer from this disorder are very A-type personalities and control freaks, because that's what it's all about. It's control and very obsessive and very tidy and, you know, things like that. And so I think getting over that hump of realizing like it's okay to not be in control was very helpful and very, very cool.
Yeah. As much as we'd love to be, we can't always be in control. We can't be in control of external things, other people. I know that we try as hard as we can to control probably every inch of what's going on in our own lives and how we look and stuff. But we, you know, there's a lot of unrealistic expectations that we put on ourselves. Those that have bodily focused repetitive behaviors like dermatillomania. And I think that's, to me, I kind of see it as a bit of a language. You know, when I'm picking a lot, I like to take a moment and ask myself, you know, what is it that I need? And what am I trying to communicate to myself? Because if, you know, if my patterns have increased all of a sudden, something's off, I need to kind of reconnect and recalibrate and find out what it is that I'm trying to communicate through picking.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in that sense, because it sounds, you know, the past few years, especially you've been in a huge journey of self-discovery with your skin picking and this huge amount of self-awareness. What would you say if you met a younger version of yourself?
I think when I was younger, particularly in middle school and high school, I worked in musical theater. I went to a music theater, a specialized high school for musical theater, and everything was about image.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, even when I went to university, I studied classical music. I was a singer. And I think about how I went to a very prestigious university for voice performance and how on my end of year term adjudications, there were two categories I was judged on: appearance and presentation. And I look at that now and I go, that's really messed up that in order to get a degree, I had to think about what I looked like. And if I could say anything to my younger self, I would say, your inherent worth and who you are is not about what you look like. And any imperfection you have or anything you don't like about yourself, you have the control to change because it's your body and you can make your body look however you want it to look. You can get tattoos, you can dye your hair, you can get piercings, you can have scars. And like, all of that isn't going to change your inner self. And I know it's easier said than done. And I probably knew that as a little kid as well. I knew that as a teenager. And I know that it's like a ridiculous thing to say because I know that in many ways I'm very privileged and a lot of people look at me and go, she's very pretty or whatever. But I think I never saw myself. I had to look at myself, how I looked at other people. Because when I befriend or date people or am intimate with people, it's really always been about their personalities, especially as someone who's like pan or bisexual or fluid. You know, I really don't fall in love with or am attracted to physical appearance first. Mm-hmm. And I never practiced what I preach when it came to my inner dialogue or talking to myself. So I think I would tell little Natasha, like, love your body. You're not always going to look like this, but also that's going to be okay.
Mm. Yeah, that's really lovely. Even though you're talking to little Natasha, little Kim, it was also listening to that, and I felt a little warm buzz from
yeah. Here. I'm so glad. I know. I'd also be like, post more bikini photos. Or something, because you're not going to look like that forever. No, I'm kidding.
Gosh, yeah, I've never been a huge fan of bikinis, two pieces, and it's like what you said earlier. I can literally count on my hands the amount of times that I've done it since puberty. I think because the whole idea just sends a cold shiver. Thank you so much for this amazing conversation. It's been wonderful. I wanted to know, before we wrap things up, your favorite quote and why, because I think it's a lovely way to see more of you.
Ooh. I'm going to quote my mother, actually, who said that people always say life is short. And yes, it can be. But life can also be really long. And it's too long to be unhappy. I like that quote a lot.
That is true. Yeah.
Because she always said, you know, you don't want to look back and suddenly 30 years have gone by and you're like, what did I do? What is this all for? So she was like, don't live your life for someone else or someone else's expectations. Live your life for you. And of course, life can be short and we should live like, you know, we only get one chance, but also with modern medicine, if we're lucky, some people live till 90 now. So yeah. Mm-hmm. Why spend years and years hating yourself, you know? So I'm learning, I'm trying to learn to be like, this is who I am. And this might be what I look like forever. And like, that's okay.
Mm. I love that. Your mom sounds like a remarkable woman. Very wise. I think that's very, very sound, wise advice that that we can all take from that. So thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, you're welcome.
And Natasha, if someone wanted to get in touch with you on social media or even check out your podcast, where would they find you?
Yeah, so my podcast is on a little hiatus right now, but I will be doing a season two eventually. It's called Vanless Presents. It was just, I jokingly said it was the podcast nobody asked for, but I made anyway, like every other asshole did during the pandemic. Made a podcast. But I'm more active on social media, less so these days, because as we said, comparison and all those doom scrolling and all those wonderful, terrible things. But anyway, but you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Nat Vanless.
Thank you so much. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Natasha. Thank you so much for taking the time for this conversation. I really appreciate it.